As I was walking one fine summer's morning, the fields and the meadows, they looked so green and gay, and the birds, they were singing so pleasantly adorning. Right early in the morning, at the break of the day, hark, oh hark, how the nightingale is singing. The lark, she is taking her flight all in the air, and in yonder green bower the turtle doves are building. The sun is just a glimmering, arise my dear.
You're listening to the intoxicating sounds of Bird Ellen singing Sweet Lemony, the traditional song that is the subject of this week's Old Songs podcast. Welcome back. I'm John Wilkes, and this is episode 2 of series 2, supported, as always, by the English Folk Dance and Song Society. And you can find out all about the work that they do and the Vaughan Williams Memorial Library, which is located at Cecil Sharp House, their headquarters, in the links that I put in the bottom of this podcast's webpage over on tradfolk.co. This week we'll be talking to Hannah Martin, who is well known for her work with Edge Larks, with her partner Phil Henry, Gig Spanner, Sykes Martin, the all-new Salt Lines project. She does so much. We'll be discussing in part her folky background, the album that she's about to put out with Sykes Martin, which of course is going to be performed at Cecil Sharp House on the 29th of September at 7:30 p.m. Again, ticket links in the webpage associated with this podcast. We'll be talking mostly about this song, Sweet Lemony, which I believe is called an obord, which is a kind of music to herald and celebrate the morning. It's a mystical piece, a celebration of the spring and the summer, with the earliest collections and connections with the poet and author Thomas Hardy. We talk all about the grand bards of Cornish tradition. We discuss John Dingle, the source singer that Cecil Sharp collected this song from in 1904. And by the way, all of the source singer information that I talk about here, especially when related to Cecil Sharp, comes from a website called cecilsharpspeople.org.uk, which I really recommend you go and have a look at. It's fantastic. Hannah talks about the all-new Salt Lines project that she's involved in with author Raina Wynne and the Gig Spanner Band. And we talk about methods of learning traditional songs, what to do and what to avoid. Loads to get into. And do stick around till the end for Hannah's unaccompanied version of Sweet Lemony. It's an absolute treat. Let's get stuck in.
As I was walking one fine summer's morning, the fields and the meadows, they looked so green and gay, and the birds, they were singing so pleasantly adorning. Right early in the morning, at the break of the day.
So this week we're chatting to Hannah Martin from Sykes Martin and Edge Larks and Gig Spanner and all sorts. Hi Hannah, welcome to the Old Songs podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about your background and sort of how you got into traditional music.
Well, I am a folk singer and songwriter from Devon. I grew up in a town called Brixham, and when I was about 10, my parents always sang and played music themselves, but in a kind of very informal way. They didn't have any proper sort of music education or anything. They just liked to strum guitar and sing Bob Dylan songs. So I grew up with that idea that singing together was a lovely thing to do. And then, I think I was about 10, and I'd started playing the violin. And we went round to some of my parents' friends' house for dinner. And those friends were folk singers themselves, a wonderful Devon folk singer called Maggie Duffy, who's got a beautiful voice and a really deep knowledge, actually, of the tradition through many years of folk clubs and being on the scene. And so she spotted my violin and she said, oh, come on, let's have a song, play a tune. And I was like, but there's no music. What, you know, I don't know what to do. And she was like, oh, go on, just by ear, have a go. And thank goodness she did, because I found that I loved the challenge of being free of the music and improvising in that way. And so I actually started playing local gigs with her when I was about, 11 or 12. And I'd just busk along to her songs, really. So that was a kind of fiddle playing thing. And then through her, started going to local folk clubs and sessions, learning lots of traditional music along the way. My parents also used to take me to Sidmouth Folk Festival, so that was a great education in itself. And I remember seeing Peter Knight playing there in Steely when I was very young and being extremely excited by his playing, and also Maddie Pryor's singing. And I was always fascinated by the stories in folk songs, especially the really long ballads. You know, I'd sit and follow them through. I ended up studying English literature, actually. I think kind of I was always very into books, and so those kind of ballads that were almost like novels really drew me in, and I'd listen verse after verse and try and work out what the heck was happening. And I remember wondering why the stories didn't always make complete sense. So that was what got me into it all, really.
11 years old, you said you started gigging, did you say? That's amazing.
I think so. I mean, I don't mean like in a sort of very hardcore way, but I, you know, Maggie would play in sort of nice local venues, you know, hotels, and sometimes we'd go to old people's homes, and she'd sort of do wonderful entertainment for people, and it was really a privilege, and I was very lucky to have that experience. But I don't mean I was out on the road. That didn't happen till later.
And you saw Peter Knight at Sidmouth, and of course you've ended up playing with him, haven't you?
Yeah, so exactly. It's this wonderful sort of strange
cyclical
coincidence
thing.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. It's wonderful, really, because he was genuinely my hero. And then I've ended up in his band. So
of course you're known particularly well for being in Edgelarks with Phil. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about them.
So I went off to uni to do like a sensible degree, and I did that and didn't really do very much music while I was there. And then towards the end of that time, I met Phil and Tobias Ben-Jacob, who you may know as well, plays in Jacob and Drinkwater.
I do.
So Phil and Toby played as a duo at that time called the School of Trobar. They were ever so good. And so we sort of, you know, saw them playing on the local scene and thought, oh yeah, I do like music. and Phil went to study music in India, and so while he was away, Toby was looking for somebody else to play like a lead instrument for him. So I ended up playing fiddle for Toby, and then when Phil came back from India, we formed a band, and that band was called the Roots Union. So those guys had been studying music and they'd got pretty into folk and world music, and so it kind of brought me back to that whole world that I was already sort of had one foot in a really nice way. So we started doing gigs, going to Sidmouth and round Glastonbury and all the festivals, and we had a great time for a couple of years playing in that band. And then when that kind of came to a natural conclusion, me and Phil had got together and we formed a duo, and that was Edgelarks.
And now you're doing Sykes Martin with Miranda Sykes. Mm-hmm. Who's a sort of stalwart on the scene as well. So, and I know that you're playing at Cecil Sharp House on the 29th of September at 7:30 p.m.
Yep.
And what can you tell me about Sykes Martin? Is that a relatively new thing, or has that been going for a while?
Well, it is new. It still feels new, but I suppose that's a sort of pandemic-y thing as well, because we've known each other for many years. Me and Phil were lucky enough to do quite a few shows with Show of Hands, and so obviously met Miranda then, but she lives locally, so we've sort of, you know, seen each other around and socialised a lot over the years. And then maybe about 3 years ago, she was at our house with her husband, Dan, for dinner, just hanging out, you know, socially. And one reason or another, somebody said, oh, let's have a song. And we sort of ended up singing and thinking, gosh, this sounds really good. We should maybe, you know, do something together. And so we got together a few more times just socially. And it sort of was very organic in that way, you know, sort of found ourselves growing this set of songs. And so we thought, yeah, let's actually do something with this. And we'd kind of put out some tentative beginnings of that. We'd got a few things booked in and thought we'd get a set together by that point, etc. And then the pandemic happened. Of course, that slowed things down a lot and kind of halted them for quite a while. So it feels like although it's been brewing for quite a long time, it is still very new. We were meant to do our debut tour last year, and sadly it was cancelled once again because of the COVID. So yeah, so this tour we're about to do is our debut tour. We've done two gigs so far, both at Sidmouth, a year apart, and they were both fantastic fun. So it's, yeah, really, really looking forward to it. And the thing about this project is that in our various other forms, we've generally done a real mix of material, and it seemed very natural for us to just keep to traditional material for this duo. Sort of an area that both of us have always had a lot of association with. But I mean, I'm a songwriter too, so I've never quite kind of just said, I'm going to just do trad stuff. So that's really nice.
What sorts of songs do you find yourself attracted to when you're doing trad stuff? I mean, obviously we're going to get onto one of them in a minute, but do you have a certain type of song? I mean, you mentioned also that you were very into the big ballads.
Yeah, I say I'm into the very big ballads. I haven't sung loads of them because they're quite intimidating to take on, you know? Like it's
aren't they? Yeah.
Exactly, you know this. I love them. I love the stories, but it's finding a way into them, you know, I feel like you have to, the right one has to come along at the right time with those. I think the songs in general, I definitely would like there to be a nice tune, so I suppose that's quite important, although I'm not averse to tweaking and rewriting a tune a little bit. And I think there are a lot of songs that I wouldn't sing. I feel like I've got more like this as I've got older, but ones that I couldn't quite bear to sing because they're too much. There's a lot of sort of quite colonial songs and a lot of child murdery type songs that I don't really feel like I'd want to sing, even though many people do sing them and interpret them in a way that's really relevant and pertinent. I think I find some of them too close to the bone. So I suppose kind of I don't know, lots of lovers parted songs seem to be a bit of a theme in the ones that I sing, but that's not particularly because of that subject matter, it's just because there's lots of them, lots of really good ones of them, I think.
Arise, oh, arise, and get your charming posies. They are the fairest flowers that grow in yonder grove. I will pluck of them, oh, sweet lilies, pinks and roses, all for my sweet lemony, the girl that I adore.
So we're going to talk today about Sweet Lemony, which has got tons of names. I'm going to do the thing that we often do on the Old Songs podcast and give it its numbers. So it's known as Roud 193, I believe.
Yeah.
Do you know any of its other names?
Yeah. To be honest, it's other names, but also other spellings, isn't it? Because it's Sweet Lemony, Sweet Lemony, Lemony, Lemady, and then there's more like Arise and Pick a Posy. And is it on a May morning? There's so many called that, but I think there is a version called something. Oh, Limady, that's a funny one.
I found Hark Says the Fair Maid, and I found One Midsummer's Morn.
One Midsummer's Morn, that's the one, yeah.
Lemon Day.
Lemon Day, that's a good version, actually. I know that version.
Mm. Who have you heard doing that version?
Actually, so Lemon Day is the variant. John Spires sings that as part of our Salt Lines project, which is one of the recent things I've been up to, and he does it so beautifully. Cornish version.
Does he sing it? Does John sing it?
He does. He sings it absolutely beautifully, and we've recorded it, so you'll get to hear that at some point.
Oh, great! Because I think a lot of people obviously know John for his squeeze boxing, I mean, his nickname is Squeezy, isn't it? But he, I've heard him sing recently with Jackie Oates, and he's got he's got a sweet voice. I didn't expect to come out of him. I don't know if that sounds insulting, but
no, I know exactly what you mean. It has got a real sweetness to it, and he's got a fantastic ear for harmony as well. So he does a lot of, you know, he just puts in a really beautiful harmony and that kind of thing. He's very skilled. Yeah, but yeah, lead singer on Lemon Day, and it's absolutely beautiful what he does. Yeah.
In your research, did you find out what that means, lemon? Like, there's a whole load of sort of different ideas about what lemon means or lemony means and that kind of thing.
Yes.
Did you pick up on any of that?
Yeah, so I think that's one of the reasons I was always interested in this song, because when I was studying English, I did a little bit of Middle English, and liman was the word for sweetheart or lover, or, you know, like a term of affection. So the theory seems to be that it's all a corruption of leman, and that actually comes from Old English.
I hope you're pronouncing it right, because otherwise lovers is lemons, which just lemon doesn't sound particularly good for oh my lemon.
I think that's nice.
That's quite sweet, isn't it? I suppose.
Yeah, I think that's really nice.
But it's l-e-m-a-n, isn't it? It's not L-E-M-O-N.
I think in Middle English it would have been L-E-M-M-A-N. And then that apparently comes from Old English, Leofman, L-E-O-F-M-A-N-N. And apparently the kind of etymology of that is leaf and man. So leaf, L-I-E-F. And I was thinking, oh, like Legion Leaf. You know,
so the Fairport album, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that's quite interesting and seems quite likely, really, because lemony isn't a common name, is it? So
I think a lot of people would like it to be. I think a lot of people hear it and assume that it's like the woman's name, don't they? And it's kind of a sweet, unusual name.
Exactly. And I think that, like, it still makes sense in that way. And the way the lyrics fall, you kind of are addressing it to lemony. Yeah, it makes sense as a song that you sing to your leman, your sweetheart.
And I picked up as well that a chap called Malcolm Douglas wrote this on the Mudcat forum back in 1999, that the song may have been related to a Cornish song called Limadi, printed in a book of Cornish songs and dances in 1966. Although he does go back a little bit later, about 3 years later, and says,
I'm not totally sure this is true.
But he kind of suggests that Lemon Day was Midsummer Morning, where people got together and did their lemoning, their sweethearting.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I just love that idea, really. I'm sold on it, even if it is just wild speculation, because I think linguistically it makes sense. And yeah, I read that too, about it being an obard, a poem or music for the dawn or the early morning. And yeah, sung by the young men or women to their sweethearts on Midsummer Morn or Lemon Day. I think we should probably bring Lemon Day back, actually. It's kind of...
It would be lovely, wouldn't it?
It would be really nice, and better than Valentine's Day as well. Like, a better way of doing it. Go and sing outside
the window. A Valentine's Day for folkies, I reckon.
Yeah, exactly.
Lemony, oh lemony, you are the fairest creature. You are the fairest creature that my eyes did see. And then she's played it over, all on her pipes of ivory. Early in the morning at the break of the day. So, just before we go a little bit further, can you tell me and the listeners what happens in the song, in the set of lyrics? What's it about?
Actually, it's quite an interesting song in that way, because not a lot happens. There's a sort of backstory that's hinted at, but really it's a love song. And there's not tons of just kind of love songs in the tradition that I'm aware of. Usually there's a lot more action or tragedy. This one, it's sort of, it is like someone singing outside their sweetheart's window, saying... There's a lot of landscape and description. It kind of takes quite a long time before you get to hear about Lemon Day. The first couple of verses are all about, you know, the birds are singing and everything's blooming and beautiful. And it, like, it has this real sense of, like, that lovely spring, summer time of year. to me. Definitely it talks about it being so early in the morning, and then it talks about picking flowers for your sweetheart, and then finally it does mention Sweet Lemony, the girl that I love, and it talks about how lovely she is. And then it goes a little bit interesting and says about she played it over on the pipes of ivory, which is a bit like, okay, somebody's serenading somebody on the pipes of ivory, but it's not quite clear what they're doing. And then there's this final sort of slightly bleak verse talking about how could my true love vanish from me? It must be her cruel parents that looked so slightly on me, all for the white robe that I once used to wear. And that's the only kind of action in the song suggests there's some kind of rupture in this very sweet love song. And there's some speculation. I think Peter Bellamy, in his notes, his version of the song, said, you know, maybe this guy, was he a monk? Was he a leper or a vicar? Like, what's the white robe all about? Yeah, so that's quite mysterious there. I don't think anyone's concluded what that means, really.
And the pipes of ivory, what's that about? Is that a euphemism?
I don't know, maybe.
These songs usually have some kind of euphemism in them. But yeah, the robes thing, I'm kind of picturing a druid suddenly.
Yeah, so me too, exactly. Yeah, very druidic, especially because of all the nature references everywhere. That sort of makes sense to me, but that doesn't really fit with the age of the song, I don't think.
I mean, that's an interesting point to get onto, is the age of the song. So what was the earliest version that you found?
I was looking at the Bodleian's collection of broadsides, and I didn't realise, but it was published as a broadside. And I think the earliest one of them says it's between 1802 and 1819. And those lyrics actually fit quite well with the ones that I know. So I suppose it's, you know, that is the same song on there. I don't know where the tune has come from, actually. I tried to find out and I didn't get anywhere with that. So I don't know if you managed to discover anything about the tune.
It doesn't change terribly much, does it? It changes in terms of the colour of his robes occasionally change. Those white robes are not always white. but largely it's quite fixed, which is... You know, which suggests that it may have gone into kind of broadside ballad form fairly early on. The earliest oral collection of it seems to have been from the author Thomas Hardy. He collected in 1820. Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's really interesting.
Because he was a bit of a fiddle player, wasn't he? And he loved his traditional songs to sort of give local natural history to the novels that he was writing. Tess of the D'Urbervilles particularly is known for its traditional songs and its use of traditional songs. And then, it kind of turns up, as you say, it turns up in a bunch of different broadsides. So Frank Perslow wrote in The Foggy Dew, which is a book that collects traditional songs from the south of England. He suggests that it was widely printed on slips, by which he means broadsides, in the 1820s by the likes of Evans Pitt and Catnach, and these were broadside publishers. Perso speculated that actually Sweet Lemony may well have even been written by this chap called Jemmy Catnach.
It's a great name.
Who was, in Perslow's words, known to dabble. I suppose known to dabble in songwriting is what he's talking about there. So.
Well, it's interesting because the early broadside that I found, the earliest one, was printed and folded by J. Pitts at 14 Great Andrew Street in Seven Dials. Possibly as early as 1802.
Yeah, so I don't know if Perslow's right there, because obviously if Thomas Hardy's finding it in the wild in sort of 1820, then that doesn't quite fit. But then it kind of turns up, doesn't it? It turns up in a bunch of places, and a lot of people connect it to the Copper family, who seem to have been recorded three different times singing this song. So Sabine Berengould collected it in 1891 from a guy called Samuel Gilbert in Cornwall.
Yes, that's John's version.
Is it?
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Well, Cecil Sharp also collected it from Sam Gilbert, the same man, in 1904, 13 years later. So he must have liked that song. It was stuck in his head for 13 years at least.
Wow. Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I've written down that someone called Henry Jenner, who was a grand bard of Cornwall, collected a different version of Lemon Day from Samuel Gilbert's son, William. but I don't have a year for that. But yeah, it's obviously a popular song in that part of Cornwall.
I wonder what a grand bard is. Do you know what a grand bard is?
Yeah, it's the Cornish tradition has a bardic element, so like the Cornish language. So I think there's some maybe Henry Jenner said he translated that version that he collected as well, or possibly into Cornish, because Cornish actually died as a language.
So, I mean, obviously it's collected in all those different places. For this song, what's particularly interesting is usually when we look at these traditional songs, they travel all over the shop.
Mm.
And this one doesn't actually leave England. It stays in England. It never, although some people have speculated that it was actually came over from Ireland, there is no evidence of it being collected in Ireland, certainly not Scotland, and it doesn't seem to have made it to America either. So it was collected 71 times in England, or at least there are 72 entries at the Vaughan Williams Memorial Library at Cecil Sharp House. And yeah, it seems to have been collected largely down where you are in the West Country, and that's possibly because the collectors were just more active down there. You know, there are versions, as we said, from the Copper family down in Peacehaven and Rottingdean in East Sussex. And then it also turns up near Rotherham, just outside Rotherham, in Whitby, and also just outside Robin Hood's Bay in Yorkshire. And those are the only examples of it. But I don't know, did you manage to pick up any information about the people that they collected from, any of the source singers?
No, there didn't seem to be a lot of that. Other than Samuel Gilbert and his son William at the Falcon Pub in the Vale of Laherne.
In the past on the Old Songs podcast, we've talked about Marina Russell, who it was collected from. So people can go back and listen to, I think, the Paul Sartin episode in the last series talks about Marina Russell, from whom over 100 songs were collected alone. And she was in Upway in Dorset. They collected this song from her as well in 1907. And we've also talked about the Copper family in previous episode with Billy Bragg in the first series. So people can go back and listen to Billy and I chatting about the Coppers. But there was one guy here that isn't particularly well known. And he was a chap called John Dingle. John Dingle was collected from in 1904, in December 1904, by Cecil Sharp. And the information I have about him, just to give it a little colour, just so we know the kind of people who were singing this song. John Dingle was collected from in December 1904 at Lew Trenchard, which was Sabine Baring Gould's manor house in West Devon. And he was 74 years old at the time. And he went up to Lew Trenchard to sing his songs to Sharp. So he had 9 songs in total, which he sang over 3 different visits. And just his background was that he was born around 1830 at Lamerton near Tavistock. And he was a farm servant from the age of 11. And by 1871, he was a farm labourer with 6 children, having married Eliza Hobbs in 1851. And he died in 1907, shortly after he met Sharp, aged 77. So it was a song from a rural working man.
How could my true love, how could she vanish from me? And how could she go where I'll never see her more? It was her cruel parents that looked so slightly on me, and it's all for the white robe that I once used to wear.
Tell me a bit about where you first heard it.
So I had to really think about that, because it's one of those songs that feels a bit like it's just in your consciousness. Like, I've heard so many different versions over many, many years to work out which one was first. I struggled. I'm sure that I would have heard it just in sessions and folk clubs growing up. But in terms of a recorded version, I'm pretty certain it was Peter Bellamy's version that was the kind of the one that I learnt the tune from, and the words that I sing are very similar to, which is a lot faster than I sing it, but it's still got that beautiful sort of modal tune. And yeah, it's lovely. And then in more recent times, I've heard some really beautiful versions, sort of contemporary adaptations. Jarlath Henderson sings a lovely version, and Bird Ellen as well, Scottish duo. So interestingly, yeah, an Irish singer and a Scottish duo doing beautiful versions of an English song, which is quite unusual, isn't it, to for things to travel so obviously in that direction.
Bird Ellen one was certainly the first that I heard. So it's not terribly long ago since I got since I was first introduced to this song.
Yeah.
Bird Ellen's version is this beautiful,
really is,
droney
yeah.
thing.
Yeah.
And I know that Nick Hart, who was the guest on last week's episode, he learned it also from Peter Bellamy, but it was the Bird Ellen version that sort of inspired him to actually want to record a version himself. You think it was Peter Bellamy that you first heard. Have you got any other versions that that you particularly enjoy?
Well, actually, I heard Bird Ellen perform it at Sidmouth a few years ago now. So that stands out in my memory as a live performance in the cellar bar in Kenaway House. And it was really stunning moment, you know. I've been trying to think of the people over the years that I've heard sing it, you know, in folk clubs and just local to me. And I think there are a few of them, which is nice because I suppose I've learnt it in that kind of very traditional way as well.
Do you find, does it alters much when you hear other people do it? Or does it, like the, as we were saying earlier, with the broadsides, it became quite fixed?
The people who I think stem from Peter Bellamy's version, which I'm pretty certain Bird Ellen said that they did, the words are quite, standardised, I'd say. But then, as I said, John Spires has done his beautiful version of Lemon Day, is what his version's called, and the words are actually quite different to that. Still very much on a theme, but there's less of the mysterious last verse where the tragedy seems to creep in and more of just the lush, summery nature bit.
When are we going to get to hear the John Spires Saltlines version?
Yeah, well, we are on tour with Saltlines in the autumn, so you can come to one of those shows in October. And hopefully in October we will also be releasing the Saltlines album. So we did the tour of the Southwest Coast Path, which is what the show's all about, in July, and we recorded those shows, and the recordings are being made into an album as we speak. But you can pre-order that, and please do, because it costs a lot of money to make an album, so we still need more pre-orders.
Sure. I will put the links, of course. I always do this in if you go to the Tradfolk website and to the Old Songs podcast section, I will put the links to these things, including that link into the information there, so people can find their way to it. Are you going to be playing at Folk East? Is that correct?
We are, yes. We're very much looking forward to wonderful Folk East in 2 weeks' time. Well, a week and a half now. We're doing the full show there.
I'm going there with Tradfolk, with the Tradfolk website. So we're going to be doing some recordings of artists singing traditional songs sort of backstage acoustically to camera. So if you can come and sing Lemony, or get John to come and sing Lemon Day to the camera, that would be extraordinary.
People
will be able to find it on our Instagram page.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. So the Saltlines project, that's all... bar one song that I wrote, it's all traditional music from the Southwest. And I'm sure John would do that for you. It's beautiful what he does.
It's connected with the book, isn't it?
Yeah, Raina Wynne. Wynne's book, The Salt Path, where she walked the entirety of the Southwest Coast Path, which is 600 odd miles. But the show is connected to that. But the idea was that there must be lots of other stories from the path. We found the traditional songs telling lots of stories from the region, and she's written totally new words to kind of link it all together and make it into this show, which it feels really wonderful to be part of. It's a lovely thing.
That's great. And is the song something that you're doing with Sykes Martin, or is... So
yes.
People who come to the house on the 29th of September at 7:30 p.m. are going to be able to hear it?
Absolutely. So before we were doing Saltlines, I was already doing Sykes Martin. We were working on this set, and I'd thought, Sweet Lemony, I want to do a version of that song. And I'd been just sort of tinkling around on my tenor guitar, come up with a bit of a riff and a thing. And I thought, wouldn't it be cool to have like a double bass solo, you know, there's not enough of them, and obviously Miranda's a fantastic double bass player. And so our version of Sweet Lemony features the harmonies that me and Miranda do, which is sort of a big part of the sound, but it also has this big double bass bowed bass sound solo section, which is I always get really excited by, because it's fantastic to hear her really playing out like that. You know, obviously it's a great instrument for accompanying, but it's lovely to hear it being played in that beautiful melodic way, and she does it so well. So that's really the thing about our version, and we will definitely be playing it at Cecil Sharp House.
Is there an album of Sykes Martin?
Yes. So the delay with it all meant that we thought, well, let's make an album while we're waiting around for the pandemic to pass. So we did over the winter. My partner Philip Henry is an excellent music producer, amongst other things, and so he recorded it for us and sort of musically directed it and helped us craft the trad songs that we'd arranged as live songs into like an album format. And yeah, so the album's called Unquenching Fire, which is the title of one of the songs. It's another really interesting song, actually. another podcast
for episode. Another time.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, yeah, the tour we're doing is the launch tour for that album.
Hark, oh, hark, how the nightingale is singing, and the lark, she is a-taking a flight all in the air, and the small birds and turtle doves on every bough are building. The sun is just a-glimmering a horizon, my dear.
We touched a little bit on the other versions that you've heard. I just wanted to go back and just sort of tell people, if they want to go and find Sweet Lemony in, I was going to say a variety of versions, but actually, as we've established, there aren't that many fragments or variations that you can find. But obviously it's been recorded by Martin Carthy, because he's recorded everything. But he did that with the Albion Band. Eliza Carthy has done a version.
Yeah.
Tony Rose, Jim Murray, the Askew Sisters, John Bowden, Andy Turner, Nick Hart, Bird Ellen, we've mentioned. There are just tons.
Barry Lister, Martin Wyndham Reed.
Do you have a tendency when you come to a song to, like, obviously you don't copy somebody else's version, but do you, certainly for example, when I'm trying to learn a song, a new song that I know, especially when I know there are Martin Carthy versions out there, I try very hard to avoid the Martin Carthy version.
Yeah. So actually, something I've found is that often when I'm searching for songs to sing, I try and just go through the books and just go from the sheet music and try and find one that I don't think I know. And then I don't do lots of research first. I just go from the sheet music and see if I come up with something that makes sense to me, that makes it my version. Because, yeah, if I look it up and find, oh, this is just another version of a song that I already know Martin Carthy's version of, yeah, it'll end up too similar.
Yeah, so it's a case of sort of allowing it all to amalgamate and sort of bubble away for a while until your own version sort of comes forth, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you sort of have to know it really well for that to happen, I think. I don't know. It seems to be extremes to me, actually. Either, like, actually for the Sykes Martin album, there's some songs on there that I actually have known really well for a very long time. Me and Miranda discovered that we both had this massive affection stemming from our childhood for Steel I Span. And so we were sitting down going through these songs, and I think at one point we said, we can't do another one that's a Steel I song. it's a really deliberately veer away from that. But the ones that we have done, there's a couple on there, Lovely on the Water and Dark Eyed Sailor, that we both knew as Steel I songs, really. I feel that I'd known them so well for so many years that I could sing them back to myself in lots of different ways and sort of get away from that, if you see what I mean, because I was so familiar with the words and the tune, I could do something new with it. So I feel like it's either that, or it's going from the sheet music and not listening to other versions until I've come up with something. If it's like an in-between level of knowledge of a song, then I can never kind of make it my own enough.
I have a tendency to find a song. I love finding songs, obviously, that I think a lot of people do. I love trying to find songs that have almost never been recorded before.
Yeah.
Seeing if I can find something like a rare gem. I have a tendency to find stuff like that and then record it far too quickly. Like, I'm just so desperate to get it down that, you know, what it needs is sort of like a little time to ferment.
Yeah, absolutely. But then I think that's actually a problem with the way the sort of music industry works, because even when I've written the song, there's this need to record it before you've had time to gig it in, really, with the way it all seems to roll on for me. And so I always find that once you've gigged it in a bit, it settles and you know the pace, and you maybe improvise a bit here and there, and it comes together so much more. But usually you've had to already record it by that point, which is a shame.
Well, the most famous example of that happening is Bob Dylan. So a lot of people go to see Bob Dylan these days, and, you know, people who go there not expecting Bob Dylan to do what Bob Dylan does, i.e. rewrite the song in the moment. Mm-hmm. You know, they'll come away saying, you know, it's not the classic version, and they're not happy with it. Mm. And I've seen interviews or read old interviews with Bob Dylan where he said, you know, in the many cases, those songs that I wrote, those classics that I wrote, you know, were written in one afternoon and then recorded the next morning. So what makes you think that actually that is the definitive version? For me, it's a continuous development of these songs. And if you listen to him play something like Tangled Up in Blue, some of the lyrics that I've heard him sing in recent years at the Royal Albert Hall and places like that bear no resemblance to the original song, because he's rewriting it all the time to see if he can perfect it. I find that fascinating. Yeah. Wonderful way
that
to make
music. That is fascinating. I also think that's a huge credit to him as a songwriter, because I find that it's very hard to change things once they get set in stone in that way. And it's a shame, but it's, I find it really hard to unpick.
Well, we can all take leaves out of Dylan's book.
We can try.
He knows a thing or two about music.
Yeah.
Okay, well, before we finish up, I just want to remind people where we can see you, particularly pointing again to the Cecil Sharp House gig on the 29th of September, 7:30 p.m. Where else are you going to be heading around the country with the Sykes Martin
tour? So the Sykes Martin tour is quite long. We start in Calstock in Cornwall, Bath, Devon, which is Cornwall again, Leicester, Norfolk, Northamptonshire, Maltby, Portsmouth, Newbury, Totnes, which is the album launch gig. We've just added that one in. And then we go up north, and then a fair bit in the southeast as well, in Kent and in Eastbourne. So check out our gig listings on the website.
And the website is?
It's actually at Edgelarks at the moment. We have got it is quite a new project. And so the sykesmartin.com URL is reserved, but where you actually need to go is edgelarks.co.uk/sykesmartin.
Excellent. And again, I'll put that in a links at the bottom.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time, Hannah.
No worries.
Good luck with the tour.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Right early in the morning at the break of the day.
Thanks again to Hannah Martin for her time and her expertise. And thanks to her partner Phil Henry for looking after their little one. You may have heard some of that going on in the background. Thanks also to the English Folk Dance and Song Society for their support. And remember that you can go and see Hannah with Sykes Martin at Cecil Sharp House on the 29th of September. Without further ado, here's Hannah Martin with Sweet Lemony.
As I was a-walking so early in the morning, the fields and the meadows, they looked so green and gay, and the birds, they were singing so pleasantly adorning, so early in the morning, at the break of the day. Oh, hark, oh, hark, how the nightingale is singing. The lark, she is taking her flight all in the air.
On yonder green bower the turtle doves are building. The sun is just a glimmering. Arise, my dear. Arise, arise, and get your humble posies. They are the fairest flowers that grow in yonder grove, and I would pluck them all, sweet lily, pink and rosy. And oh, for sweet Lemony, the girl that I love. Oh, Lemony, oh, Lemony, you are the fairest creature. You are the fairest creature that ever my eyes did see. And then she's played it over all on the pipes of ivory. So early in the morning, at the break of the day. Oh, how could my true love, how could she vanish from me? Oh, how could she go and I never see her more? But it was her cruel parents that looked so slightly on me. And all for the white robe that I once used to wear. As I was a-walking so early in the morning, the fields and the meadows, they looked so green and gay. And the birds, they were singing so pleasantly adorning. So early in the morning, at the break of the day.